But in those days, you went into work and you knew how to work. You had piled cordwood, so you knew how to pile a pile of lumber.
Oh, I see.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And you'd been sweeping floors and all that. You could turn. You knew that the floor had to be cleaned without the foreman telling you. You know, you did a lot of things that you... Well, I still do that. I don't expect a foreman to tell me what to do next. I don't sit and wait. If my machine breaks down and I know there's something to do, I... But he was just as much concerned about their job as the rest of us, you know. And it isn't that I'm that concerned about my job now. It's just that I like to work and I do it.
Maybe also then, because women were sort of a novelty, the men had been used to doing that kind of cleaning.
Yeah, I think it was, you know.
Yeah.
I might be because I was young and I didn't notice it so much as I do. I would notice it now. You know, you don't notice things. And then you're raised, too, with certain jobs are women's jobs, certain jobs are men's jobs in the home. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
Boys don't wash dishes. My mother never expected my brothers to wash dishes. I had two of them. And one was only 2 years younger than I was, and I never saw him wash a dish in my life.
Right.
And she'd say, well, that's girls' work. You girls get your work done now. You boys go and get your work done. You know, there was strictly a... But if they needed help to haul wood or saw wood, you still went and helped them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you went to work with that attitude. That was really in your head. And you never thought of it.
Right.
Or if you thought of it, why don't the boys do something too? You girls keep quiet now. You know, it's an attitude you had. The same as even today with all the struggling we've had. Those problems come up in naming girls to a will, or executors of wills, or it's still the boys. It's that generation is never, even when they believe there should be equality, they'll say it in words, but their actions speak are different.
So this is sort of your mother and older women. And
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yet, if you talk to her, she'd tell you right out, oh no, she believes in fairness for women. Women should get equal pay and all that sort of stuff. And then after a while, they say, well, she's got lots of money. She's earning so much money in the mill at the mill, $8 an hour or whatever. Good gracious, she's got money. Why, you know, let her pay for it and that sort of thing. Like as if you hadn't earned it.
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't she quit her job and give her job to somebody else? Well, you know, I earned my job. Mm-hmm. I'll fight for jobs for other people, but I'm not going to give up the one I've got. That's my job. Let everybody fight for theirs, too. We'll struggle together for jobs for everybody. And I believe there should be jobs for everybody.
Right. So, So were you supervised by men?
Yes. We had one woman supervisor in Hammond Cedar.
Right. And was the supervision...
By the way, part of the reason for the supervision not being too heavy, don't forget, it was hard to get help.
Right.
They had to begin to get more carefully. And When they start getting the women, they were afraid then once they had the women in there, they didn't want them to quit on them and have nobody. The profit question had to come in, eh?
Yes.
So they didn't, they were a little bit, they didn't up and fire everybody like they did during the 30s.
Right.
They began to get softer on that question. So this is why. It's the war that did that. The shortage of
labor.
Of labor. Right. There's a difference between unemployment and shortage of labor.
Okay. So, we were discussing that and talking just from a political point of view. What is it we're doing? What, you know, all those things. She says, well, some of it is women get even advantages. Is that a fair way to treat? Is that a right, correct way to act?
To resolve.
You know, it's not going to give us any freedom. It's not going to give us our rights. It's not going to give us it's not going to change anything.
Right.
Can you talk a bit about what they did and, you know, how they dealt with both workers on the shop floor and a bit in the industry?
Well, one thing about it, they started to discriminate by increasing wages to try and stop people from joining the union. And then they had the machine that was anti-union, that was favoring anything that they would say. And people, you know, there was a fear still of shutting down and being without a job. If, and they had that fear, but then they couldn't fire you. during the war.
Right.
So, and then the shortage of labor, you know, protected you from being fired. But after a shutdown like that, well, they didn't have to hire you back if they didn't want to.
So that's one of the things they were doing,
yeah,
to deal with.
Yeah, this is what they were doing.
Did they victimize individual people?
Oh, yes. They put them in a job that they didn't like, maybe, or they'd put them on the green chain and put them in a position where they either had to quit or give 7 days' notice. And we had to give 7 days' notice during the war.
Then you'd go to the selective mm-hmm. service then?
Yeah, they'd go to selective service, find some other job.
Right.
I can't anymore. And they, like I say, they had their tools around to talk against the Union or stop the Union. But that's about all during the war. It was a shortage of labor that they were hesitant to put any more pressure other than shutting the place down. And they used, I guess they must have got the rate from the government, because, you see, they weren't anything that was for the war effort, and Cedar was, and Hammond. And I know plywood was, and the plywood industry and all those, it was necessary. So to shut down, they had to get, I imagine, must have had to get some sort of permission. They had to have a real good excuse, as far as I could see, because they weren't supposed to shut down.
Right.
No.
So
that was our main thing they did at Hammond,
yeah.
To shut her down.
Yeah. And did people respond? Were they intimidated by it?
There was a certain amount of intimidation. You see, people, the ones that worked in Hammond, they all had their homes around the area. And, you know, it was a sort of like a company town, and a lot of people lived around Haney. Most of the workers right around that area didn't travel too far.
So people were afraid of losing...
losing their job that was close to home, eh?
Right. Did the employers at all try and use the fact that there were women working in the mill to divide the workforce in any way, or pit men against women?
Not until after the war. I don't know. I don't think so.
And were there any strikes or sort of wildcats or struggles
going
on?
No. We waited in a disciplined fashion, really.
And that was because there was a no strike pledge, is that maybe?
Part of it is no strike pledge, and you... And you didn't, you know, it's not like now where that's used a lot. You know, you had to, you know, to go on strike. You now you sort of there's a sort of a, you'd use it as an undercurrent thing. You know, you'd say, well, they won't come through with such and such a grievance, or they won't come through with your wage contract. We'll have us, you know, how they do that. You do that in the industry now the same way as you do in the post office workers or any of the other organizations. It's a thing not advised by the leadership, but the suggested, possibilities are there, because you're harassing the, you know, you're not coming through with a wage contract, and we don't like that. You know, the people don't like that. They sort of, that's where it starts, sort of spontaneous. Some of it is might be carried on. I know Fraser Mills in the past was a couple of those. Maybe I shouldn't even say that so it gets on the tape, but there was a couple of times that they were shut down partly because the weather was too hot, I think. They just wanted to, you know, shut her down. We went back to work.
So,
but no, generally speaking, there's no one will go through a picket line.
Right.
We had two, the last two went through the picket line. One time the loggers put up a picket line and two people went through. But generally, most very seldom that anybody will go through a picket line.
Right.
You know, it's just, it has to be somebody that's just anti-union.
So, at this time, what kind of tactics did you use in the union in order to win things, grievances?
We didn't really have any tactics. We didn't. We didn't have any slowdowns in those days. We didn't. It was again the war effort, eh? It was a pretty disciplined crew, where if they negotiated for an increase, it was strictly on negotiations.
What were the main issues for establishing contracts in the wood industry, the first ones?
Wages. Hours. Improvement in conditions like canteens and bathrooms, cleaning up, cleaner toilet, you know, all those sort of things like that. Not necessarily in the contract, but these were all things that were used.
Did the employers, because there were women working, do anything like put in new bathrooms?
Yes, they all did. Mm-hmm. We had a special bunkhouse built at Hammond Cedar, kind of cold in winter, but with toilets on one end. And the men were, and by the way, a lot of these places only had gunny sack toilets before women came. You know, just a sack around where a man could go over and hang it over the river or something. You know, it was, when women got a toilet, when women were hired, they had to have these toilets and that, so they built them for men too. Usually right from end to end, they'd have the men on one end and the women at this, the other end. But there was no, like Hammond Cedar didn't have a canteen and had never heard of a restroom, you know, for your breaks. That was the first the women had.
Right, so women were really instrumental in just their presence in establishing
some of these things.
And did that come from the government in part?
Regulations? That, I think, was regulations from the government to hire women, to have women in there.
So how did people also work out a first contract? Was there, was it a master contract that was made out in the industry?
Yeah.
And then did you
applied to all the mills as they come along, as
so
you organize them.
So you had your own
local demands? You know, as far as the IWA, it was done on a regional basis, same as now, only thing was districts in those days. Once a union contract was established with one mill, you tried to establish it in that same union contract in another mill. The same as you do now. If you organize an unorganized plant, the union contract that's sitting there is what you try to establish in that plant, in the new plant that's organized. The contract we have.
Get uniform conditions.
Get uniform conditions.
Right.
There are some mills at this local here, you know, it's reported almost every month that what mill got organized, where you got certification and that sort of thing, and then you're trying to establish the union contract you have now.
Mm-hmm. Is it 1946 when?
I think it was 46. I think that was the first IWA strike.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The logging camps have had strikes. Not during the war, I don't believe, but during the 30s. And Fraser Mills had a strike during the 30s. But Hammond Cedar, I don't remember having any strike until after 1946.
Was there a big change when the federal government and the provincial government allowed unions to organize, like when they legalized the process of unionization? Did that have a big effect on the organizing process?
I can't tell you whether they did or not. I think those that were convinced to be in union, I don't think necessarily that it made it legal would make that much difference. Might have. I can't really remember. See, I've always been in an organized place, and the IWA has been considering a lot of union, a lot of other organizations, that it was quite a well-organized... When did the government make it legal to be in the union?
It was during the war.
It was during the war.
I think it may have been beforehand. And then in 1945, I think they brought in...
legislation to... by that time, I think a lot of the big mills were organized.
Right.
So I don't think that there was that much... I imagine it must have had its effect, though. See, I was working in the union office in 1945.
How did you get that job?
When I came back from the logging camp,
right.
I was home and I wasn't working. So they were looking for an office girl. And it wasn't that it took on a lot of whatever typing I could learn in the union office, they said. And I said, well, gee, I'm not a typist and I'm not a bookkeeper. Well, you can learn, the girl will stay. Yeah, the girl we have now will stay till you're trained. So I learned a hunt and peck system, I guess, and learned the bookkeeping. I was fairly good at figures. So I got on then.
Right.
And that's when she trained me for about 6 weeks, I guess, and the rest of the bookkeeping I did. Lots of times I had to work overtime because, you know, not being experienced, not having the actual training, had to just pick it up that way. I learned to do the bookkeeping and learned to type and make stencils and minutes and that sort of thing. And it was somebody, too, to answer the phone, sign up people, collect union dues, and which I'd already experienced on that.
Right.
So I was on there. And then I met Bergen, my first husband. And I didn't know he was anti-union until after I'd married him. Then he kept harassing me because I was working in the union office. And I said, well, if it'll make you happy, I'll quit. So I quit, but that didn't help any. Well, I left him just before my daughter was born. Then I went back to him, and then I left him. She was about a year and a half old, and I left him permanently. I divorced him. But I didn't divorce him till she was five.
So you were then a woman with a child who you had to support?
Yeah.
And when was this? This was 1946?
She was born in June 45. And this was, wasn't involved in the 46-48 dispute.
Because you were out of that.
Because I was out of the union office then. But I was, I still worked picking berries and took my child with me and things like that. And when I left him, I went to work in a restaurant for a short time, about a year and a half, and then I went back to Fraser Mills.
Right.
So this would be, I started in Fraser Mills in February 1951. In between that time, I did other job, restaurant work, and, you know, helped at home on the farm. My mother had a cattle farm at this time, milk cows.
When you were a restaurant worker, were you in a union?
No.
No.
I was a jack of all trades. I cooked in a restaurant, and I waited tables, and I took cash, and everything. This was in the Langley Hotel for about a year, and then I quit there and I come to Royal City Cafe here in New Westminster. And I kept used to always say there should be a union in here. And they didn't get organized till after I went to Fraser Mills. And I went to Fraser Mills in February 51.
Are they still organized?
They're organized. Well, I think they are. I believe they are. I haven't checked. I haven't looked.
Yeah.
You know, but a lot of those restaurants aren't organized.
Oh, it is. It is probably.
Why that's fallen apart, I don't know.
I think it's tricky.
We're off the track again.
That's okay. So, you were working at the Royal City Cafe and it wasn't organized?
No, it wasn't organized.
Okay, then you got back. Okay, so...
I've only had my one daughter anyway.
Yeah.
I picked berries in the summertime when I took the buggy and the baby, yes, when she was born. She was born June the 20th. I went picking strawberries as soon as I come out of the hospital.
Right.
With her in the berry path.
How did you... And you worked at various temporary jobs?
Temporary jobs, mostly doing this. I'm doing a little bit of store work and a little bit of housework for someone. I'd take my buggy out because there was no... He didn't stay too steady at any job.
So it must have been pretty hard to sort of survive on that.
Yeah, but as I remember it now, I don't... You know, I can't... It's, you know how the bad things in life have sort of slipped by? You sort of...
Yes.
Ignore it. I never took any. And then when I left him, I went to work in the Langley Hotel. I paid my mother what the welfare would pay to take care of a child in those days, for her to take care of my little one.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went to work at the Royal City, and then when I come back home, when I was working in the Royal City, I had to get a room because you couldn't, there was no buses or anything like that to go back and forth from work. So then she sold her farm and moved to New Westminster. So then I moved back home and paid her board for my daughter and paid board for myself. But I worked on a shift. I took graveyard at Fraser Mills. First I worked the afternoon shift. But as soon as she started school, I took graveyard. So this way I was home early in the morning to take her to school, because we were right close to Edmund School. And then I was up in the afternoon. I'd go to bed as soon as I took her to school, and then get up in the afternoon when she got home from school, and then I'd go to bed with her in the evening.
So you just split your sleep?
Well, I always did that. I've done that all my life. I've did it ever since I've been at Fraser Mills on the graveyard shift. I still do it. It became a habit.
Exactly.
So consequently, all I needed really was a babysitter at night. You know, somebody to sleep, so Mom was there. There was always someone at home. So that, but I was there more sort of to supervise my own child. And she grew up that way, even when she was going to university.
Was that difficult? Did that create a lot of pressure?
It created a certain amount of pressure, yes, because you see, you're not, there's so many grown-ups. We had all my brothers and sisters were home, and my mother, and I had my two brothers, and Louise, and Annette, and then Mom had a couple boarders, one boy that was sort of adopted, he's sort of part of the family. He was 13 when his parents died. So he came to stay. My brothers, he came to BC as a little kid, as 13. He was 13, looking for work. And when he came to BC, my brothers found him, or started talking to him, and he had no place to stay, so they brought him home. So after that, he was always part of the family. He comes to the weddings, comes to affairs. It's when there's a funeral, he's there. You know, my one brother died, and so it's always been a sort of a part of the family. And there was Addie, another, and a girl, but she didn't stay with us that long. But this boy has always been part of the family. So all these people around a house with a two-bedroom home on Davy Street. The garage was closed in and fixed up, my brother, and heated with electric heater, and that's where the boys stayed. You know, today that would be so illegal. But nobody reported us. I suppose it was illegal then too.
Yeah.
But you never even give it a thought.
Right.
And all the girls stayed in the house. So it was my mother, my daughter, Annette, and Louise, and Madeleine. That was all the women in two bedrooms in the house. That's quite a slew.
Yeah, that is.
Too many. Even when somebody come to visit, he felt so crowded.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
So that's pressure, you know. At the time, you don't think of it. And I suppose it was all right. Wasn't all that bad for maybe the ones that were working, but it must have been pretty tough on my mother. As I see it now, I must have been ready to tear my hair. But she did a lot of on that lot. She'd garden, she had raspberries, she had flowers, and said, so she'd go outside, I guess, to get away from it all, just garden me.
And she looked after your daughter.
And she looked after my daughter.
Right.
That wouldn't have been, you'd have found somebody else to look after them, you know. We had Betty Lou, one neighbor. She always took her to May Day, and while I was in the summertime, she'd take her down. They adopted her, like all the neighbors adopted her. They were watching for her all the time. You know, they sort of... The kids all played together in that street.
Right.
So if there was anything, if they got hurt, somebody, one neighbor would pick up your kid and take it home. If it was another one's kid, they'd pick it up and take it home. You know, and say, well, it was hurt. And the little kids would go picking the neighbor's flowers, and of course they'd come home and say, you're not supposed to pick the flowers. And this child picked flowers. You know, there was Davy Street was a very responsible neighborhood for the children. I think it's better then than it is now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so.
Right. Well, during the war, when there were a lot of women in industry, how did they deal with childcare? Were there discussions about kids?
No. Mostly there was always some relative that took care of your children.
So that's how it was resolved?
No, it was never even discussed. They were either in school, old enough to be in school, or their neighbor, or their mother. In the war, during the war, see, their husbands would go, and they'd either be living with their mother, or their mother-in-law, or something like that, and that was the other woman that would go to work.
Yeah, and support the whole...
Sort of support the whole thing, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
And this was, see, because there was a war allowance that the wife got.
Yeah.
For the children and herself, and then she went and had a job so everybody could live together. And I think that's partly what come out of our family too, as well, living together on welfare. You had to sort of stay together. So you came home with your whatever wages you earned too, to help out, because if one went to work, you were knocked off the allowance, see? So there was an instinct of protection there or something, I guess.
Right.
That's how you did it, you know, you just...
But to say you thought it out that way, it just worked that way. And as far as how taking care of children, I think most women figured their mother or somebody else that was home. And because there was always supposed to be somebody at home to make the meals and make the beds and do the washing and that sort of stuff, that was an expected thing. The person that was home took care of the family.
Would do that. Right. Okay. So, and people in the neighborhood and in the community, did most of the women work in your community then?
No.
No. Even during the war, eh?
No, just a very small percentage. A lot of them were single girls.
Yeah.
And a odd woman here and there. No, there wasn't in our community, they didn't all work. No, it would be a small percentage.
Right.
You know, just those few that have the, either the initiative or the, hey, why not go to work? You know, sort of adventurous mm-hmm. type of woman that went out to work.
Oh, yeah,
you know, the others, if they were married, you stayed home.
Right.
That was expected.
Also, I guess people would work if they had to at the moment.
And then the other one, the economic question.
So did the women who worked tend to hang together, kind of, as a group, or...?
Not really. I don't think so. No. No, because we were friendly with all our neighborhood women that didn't work.
Right.
But see, we were single. So they accepted you to go and work while you're single.
Mm-hmm. It was just if you were married.
If you were married now, they might have looked at it different.
Yeah.
But I never dawned on me, you know. Right. I know my mother didn't go to work. A little bit in the cannery. In Haney. A couple times of short seasons, short spells. She never stayed on a job more than 3 or 4 weeks. And she picked berries a few times, you know, short kicks here and there. The rest of the time she stayed home.
So what happened in the forest industry when the layoffs began? When did the layoffs begin and how did they affect the industry and women in particular?
Well, when the layoffs came into the picture and there was like the IWA had a big campaign and car cavalcade to Chilliwack or Hope or somewhere protesting laying off of women.
Really?
That there was a lot of women. Phyllis Matheson, I wonder, you know, she's one that you probably, was a strong NDPer. She's in Millardville. She took part in that. And she used my name or used me as an example. Because I was a woman alone with a child to support. And there's no way that women should be laid off. And I think it was around... What agreement they made at that time, I don't really know. But I do know that Phyllis was involved in making an agreement that would be certain jobs for women in Fraser Mills. This isn't Hammond, this is Fraser Mills.
Yeah.
And we were segregated, but we also kept a lower wage than the men. See, we're still getting lower than men. So there were certain jobs designated for women at that time.
So
then there was a change later on when there was, every time there was a layoff in plywood, of course women went out the door. But you'd be called back because of the contract conditions. Then finally, all of a sudden, there was the sawmill had a layoff. And men were laid off that had more seniority than women. So then there was a struggle that everybody's going to be laid off and men would take those women's jobs. But they took it at the basic rate for men, not the basic rate for women.
That whole thing really raises the whole question of affirmative action in there.
Then that's when you start talking more on the question, and it showed up as a cheap labor. And I brought a motion that equal pay for equal work. In our local, the equal pay for equal work question didn't finally reach an agreement, or didn't finally reach the idea to be negotiated, I think it was 1957. Finally, the men adopted and went to convention action.
So the women in part at least kept their jobs in the forest industry after the war because they weren't...
Those that wanted to stay. A lot of women quit because of the idea. As soon as this was planted, you know, as soon as this was stated that they weren't going to hire, like at Hammond, the Fraser Mills, they weren't going to hire any more women. When we got equal pay for equal work, the year we got equal pay for equal work. Now, I'm not sure what year that came. But they quit hiring women. Also because of men being laid off from the sawmill and men coming in to take the women's jobs, and they said, well, that's fine, we're not going to hire any more women. And I was only one voice on the executive of the plant down there, so they couldn't, you didn't have a chance. Say, well, this wasn't fair, you should still hire women. I stated it, but the men were in sort of agreement to this, too. You see, they saw the unemployment that was beginning to get unemployment and that sort of thing, so they saw jobs for men instead of women. But now there's the change again. There's tokenism. They're hiring some women. Like, they have to hire some of the women that were working in Banply, that were working in the industry. And they have hired some new ones, you know, young ones. But it's just here and there, just to make the law look, you know, make the thing look good in front of the law, in front of the government, you know, that they are hiring a few women and they're not discriminating. But really, they're still discriminating. After all, 50% of the population are women.
Yeah, right. Percentage of
them. That's right.
So, do you think that both during the war and then afterwards, that some of the responsibilities that women had in terms of their home life, like, you know, sort of the double work day and stuff like that, did that affect their ability to participate in the union?
Yes, it did. Oh, yes.
Okay, how did that happen?
They had too much to do. With coming home and doing the housework and the laundry and the scrubbing and all that sort of stuff, there's just too much to do. They couldn't take part in the going to union meetings when the dishes had to be done or supper had to be made or the children had to be taken to the hospital or any number of things would prevent a woman and stop her, even if she had in mind to go to a union meeting.